Welcome to the People in the Red Vest, a podcast of the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, the IFRC. I'm your host, Alexandra Sasha Goryshuk, and in each episode, we feature inspiring, surprising, and thought-provoking conversations with people who dedicate their lives to helping others.
To me, invest means mentoring. And again, I'm going to put it on women. For us women to take the time, if we see someone with potential, to identify. But if we also see someone who needs a little help to get a correction, of course, that we take the time to do that.
My belief is if you create a level playing field in a true sense, the women are capable of competing. They have the same capacity, if not more, to compete.
On this special edition of People in the Red Vest podcast, we are commemorating the International Women's Day with a theme this year, Invest in Women, Accelerate Progress. And with me today, I am very pleased to welcome Mr. Jagan Chepagain, the Secretary General of IFRC, and Ms. Kate Forbes, the President of IFRC. And as we noted just before we started recording this interview, this is the first time that I sit together with two leaders of the organization, one female and one male. I'd like to hear your response to that first. Would you care to start, Kate?
Well, I think it's really exciting, and it is different. And, it's establishing new relationships. Although Jagan and I worked together in the past, clearly this is a different role. And even though we'd worked together in the past, we've had to learn how to communicate with each other. And I've had to learn to say, wait a second, Jagan, I don't understand. Please clarify. And he, to me as well. And every time we've done that, our relationship has come out stronger than when we started the conversation.
No, I think very, very similar experience. For me, it has always been my view that when you are in a partnership, and of course, Kate and I know each other for quite a long time, of course, in different roles and different capacities. But one of my motto has always been that in any of these relationships, listening is extremely, extremely important. Of course, you always share things. I have been in the job now more than 4 years, so I have a lot to share. But there's also a listening part. Kate started a few months ago, so she brings a lot of fresh perspective that I may not have seen in the last 4 years. So that listening is extremely important part of my philosophy, but also in this relationship, this becomes extremely important. And when you listen, then you learn. And when you learn, you become a better leader. And that's sort of been the partnership. I think that's how we have started. And there is also an absolute commitment. I think the big thing, while still learning, the big thing what we have seen is absolute alignment on our policy, priority, and strategy on how we can become better as one United Federation. And that really excites me.
I think Jagan's being very modest. Yes, I agree with everything he says, but he left out flexibility. Yeah. So let's get real. We women are, we think a bit different, and we're used to multitasking, and I'm probably used to giving a bit more orders than I should be. And Jagan has very much, as he said, listened and helped me. And I agree with him. One of his, I've had to listen and I'm learning from him. And I think if we both go through this, we both have lots to learn and it's happening.
That's a great start for today and for the next 4 years. So over the years, I'm going to turn to you, Jagan, first, if I may. Over the years, the IFRC has made many commitments in terms of gender equality, and most recently, well, it's been 20 years now of the Me Too movement, there was a recognition that still much more needs to be done. So where do you think we stand now? What else remains to be done in that respect?
I think my feeling is that in these many years, I think there have been some good progress being made. When I started in 1996 to work internationally, the situation was quite different. Also, not only from the gender perspective, but also from the diversity perspective. You know, when I first joined the IFRC at that time, I had to join through a special project called Delegates from Non-Traditional Sources, meaning that, you know, if you are not from the global north, you would not be delegate. So that's why you are called a non-traditional sources. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that was 1996, so not that long ago. So if we see from there to where we are now, clearly, you know, we are much more diverse. And also if we look from the gender's perspective, clearly, you know, again, if I compare that, it's much more diverse coming to Geneva, but also in our field operations. But we are clearly not where we should be. In the sense that if you look, if I start from the secretariat first, I think our biggest weakness is on the middle management level. I think we have done good progress in the last few years on the senior leadership, close to 50-50. And we have always been quite good, actually, more at the junior level. But I think our biggest challenge has been the middle management in the secretariat. And without a strong pipeline in the middle management, we don't sustain the gender equality in the long run. And this is our current challenge, including in Geneva, but mostly in our heads of delegations positions. I think we've done quite well in Europe and in Pacific, but in some of the other regions, we have a long way to go to that equality. And when we go to the membership, that's actually, we have much more to do. I think I'm very glad that we now have a gender balanced governing board and we have a female president. I think we have made that progress. But when we look at the National Society leadership, we are nowhere close to where it should be. And without that pipeline in the National Society leadership, of a gender balanced National Society leadership, it will be very difficult to sustain that diversity at the federation level. So for me, I think focusing on that pipeline in the secretariat, in the middle management, and the National Society leadership would be key if we are to sustain some progress we have made.
Thank you, Jack. And Kate, the same question to you. Where do you think we are now with gender equality at the organization? And what can you do as a new female president to encourage that gender balance?
Well, I can tell you what I did as the chair of the Audit and Risk Commission. For my first term, I was the only female, all male. So we actively went out and recruited, and the current Audit and Risk Commission has more females than males. Mm-hmm. So I think we as women have an obligation to not only mentor, there are many very qualified women out there, to go out and expose them to the opportunities. Many of them weren't even aware of the opportunity. So it is educating them, making them feel welcome and feeling comfortable. Because oftentimes, unfortunately, women sometimes are more reluctant to take that leap into the unknown than they should. And so part of my role would be to do that. What I'm very excited, something I've planned in October, is bringing in female presidents to have them on a panel for major donors to see what women are doing, because that's the pipeline I need to work on to get more increase on the governing board as well. So part of it's walking the talk, part of it's being aggressive and creating opportunities. I need to create opportunities where I can showcase women.
If I may stay with you, thank you, Kate. The theme we mentioned earlier of this year's International Women's Day is invest in women. What does that concretely mean to you personally, and what should it mean to us as an organization?
I mean, that's a great question. I mean, part of it, invest, you could take the traditional answer and say, let's be sure that they have an opportunity to take a class or they have an opportunity to go here. But to me, invest means mentoring, and oftentimes you need to sit down and have kind of a hard conversation with women and say, this is how you have to act, who you have to reach out to, actions you have to take. And so I think invest to me is, again, I'm going to put it on women. For us women, for women to take the time, if we see someone with potential, to identify. But if we also see someone who needs a little help to get a correction, of course, that we take the time to do that.
Mm-hmm. That's a really, really important message that you just gave, I think, to us, to our audiences, and to us as staff internally. So thank you for that. Over to you, Jagan. In what ways do you think can investing in women contribute to more effective, more sustainable humanitarian outcomes?
No, I mean, maybe I can start from where Kate left. I think it would be extremely important to look at the investment at different level. Mm-hmm. You know, the first level would probably be, you know, the policy, strategy and framework level, because without that, you don't have a foundation mm-hmm. to build on. And I know some good work have been done and some work needs to continue. And then it goes much more at a practical level. Practical level means also creating a level playing field. Mm-hmm. It's not about going and, you know, do this or do that. My belief is if you create a level playing field in a true sense, the women are capable of competing. Mm-hmm. They have the same capacity, if not more, to compete. And I think creating that, and sometimes these are very simple things, you know, how you advertise, how you write the job description, how you form the panel for the interviews, whether it is an inclusive panel or not. Or, as you know, we are increasingly doing now on the, not focusing on the IQ test, but on the EQ test, mm-hmm. because that's where I think you differentiate. So I think, and then the third level is absolutely some of these very practical things of mentoring, accompanying, supporting, and maybe once in a while that tough love you talked about, Kate, yeah. you know. And combination of this, I think, create that opportunity. Now, I think this is a common sense that when yeah. you have an inclusive workforce, a diverse workshop, it just makes the workforce better. You know, it's mm-hmm. it just reinforces the knowledge and the approaches, it brings the creativity and innovations, and it also increases the collaboration among the team. So when you put all that together, it definitely impacts the positively on mm-hmm. on the humanitarian service delivery. Right now, if you look at Afghanistan, for example, you know, most of the people who benefit from the health services in Afghanistan run by the Afghan Red Crescent Society supported by us are women. And in that particular culture, if we don't have that diverse workforce that includes the women doctors and nurses and midwives, it's impossible to deliver that services. You know, it looks simple, but it's so fundamental. So having that gender and diversity is just not a slogan. And it's really fundamental to get the effective and efficient humanitarian
response. And I would just like to add to that. I think, yes. you know, we know that women and children are more impacted by the work, mostly. Absolutely. Whether it be violence or disasters, they're impacted. And I do think by having women who can relate to them, we're more likely to be able to give the aid they really need in a more timely and meaningful way. They just relate. So when you look at who we serve, women are key for our success going forward. Absolutely.
We spoke about gender balance within the IFRC and among leadership, but how do we ensure that we invest in women, that women are empowered and equal, have equality and equity at the grassroots level in the communities, the affected communities where we work?
I think, you know, the approach we have taken as IFRC with the national societies, and particularly, I think, after the 2005 tsunami, this approach has become stronger, which we now call community engagement accountability. Initially, we used to call it beneficiary communications. And that has really helped us to get some of those feedbacks from the communities. And through those feedbacks, you can get the information, which is the real information coming from the communities, and you will see if this is not representative of the communities, you know, men, women, elderly, young people, you will see the response not effective. Mm-hmm. So through the initiative like CEA and so number of instruments we have, you know, we have PGA tools, PGI tools, these ensures that during the assessment phase, there is a participation. There is a program development phase, there is a participation, and then an actual service delivery phase, there is a participation. And increasingly, actually, I have a very interesting story I can share with you a bit later. Increasingly, putting the voice of the female in the decision making. And if you don't do that, sometimes you can make fundamental mistakes. Mm-hmm. There, because the understanding can be very, very different. So our tools and some of the policies we have designed encourages that and supports that. Of course, in some of the cultural contexts, it becomes a lot harder because the communities are the reflection of the society. But increasingly, I think we are gaining momentum, and the initiative like the CEA helps us. I share this story. You know, it's my first job in Nepal. I was managing a refugee camp, and we had this issue of loss of, we are doing a food distribution to 9,000 refugees, and we had the food lost every weekend. You know, we tally the and we always had a loss, and we had a lot of discussion, consultancies, and all those type of things. Nothing found the solution, and suddenly one day I was visiting the camp, and I got into the women's group. They were discussing something, and they just invited me to join their conversation. And I just told them, I just asked them, listen, we are facing this problem. Do you have any solution? And you know what they told me? Put the women as in charge of distribution. Mm-hmm. And initially, I thought, what are they saying? And then they explained to me that, listen, as women, because we manage the house every time, and especially in the refugee camp situation, we have so little. So we are careful of every grain and every drop of oil. And we took that decision. In 8 refugee camps, we changed and we made women in charge of the distribution. Zero loss. Mm-hmm. Within a month, we achieved zero loss. And that's the different understanding the cultural context, but also understanding that care they brought on the programming was a big eye opener, mm-hmm. big eye opener for me. So that's sort of, you know, I was only 27 that time, mm-hmm. and I was not married, so I didn't have my wife to teach me every day at home. Mm-hmm. That was the biggest lessons I had learned, and that's something I have always tried to use in the programming moving forward.
Thank you.
Well, I guess I'll talk about investing in women and youth from a governance standpoint. Mm-hmm. Again, a bit of a story. When I started at my branch 40 years ago, mostly the women were volunteers and the leaders were all male. And so one of the things we're doing now is through our youth council, where we have a majority are female on the youth council, and we are creating them to be the future leaders and current leaders. In fact, one of them recently became head of CORI. But using that, that's how we're investing in youth to become leadership and in women.
Yeah.
And as they are role models, more women will come to there, which will bring more women in governance, and they will, you know, ultimately end up on the governing board. So I'm very excited about our youth council and the role the young women are playing on the youth council.
And, you know, because I just returned from Zambia and Malawi, you know, the Zambia responding to cholera, you know, it's a terrible cholera situation there, you know, completely preventable and treatable disease, you know, killed more than 600 people and 100,000 people getting sick. And in most of the leadership positions there, the Zambia Red Cross runs these oral rehydration points. It's all led by women. Mm-hmm. And most of the people who come for service are women. And that was really good to see. And in Malawi, it was something similar. This was the impact of a cyclone Freddy from last year. And some of the programs they are still doing, some of the recovery programs is still happening. Also the impact of the cholera from last year, it is still happening. And there is absolutely, the National Society has ensured that in these communities there are women community volunteer leaders, the brands leaders, and them ensuring there is a proper representation. The village I visited where they had the rehabilitation program, it was all led by women, because the people who benefited from the rehabilitation program were women-headed families because they had lost their husbands. And it was really, really impressive to see that program just a couple of weeks ago.
Can I turn to both of you now? If we're thinking in terms of being leaders in the humanitarian space, or any space really, it is often said that women cannot have it all, or that it's perhaps easier for men to balance their professional and personal lives. I'd like to ask that question of both of you. How have you navigated that balance, Kate, as a woman leader? And how do you, as a male leader, Jagan, see your role in empowering women in the workplace while allowing them to have that work balance?
It's a question I'm often asked. And, you know, it's not easy. It really isn't easy. And at least in my case, you still have waves of doubt that was I everything I should have been to everybody. In my case, I've been incredibly, incredibly fortunate. I had two sets of parents, sets of grandparents that would help. I had the financial ability to have help come in, so I didn't have to do housework. I mean, I could come home and enjoy the children. But I think you need to sit down, and I have an incredibly, Jagan has been a supportive husband who was willing to pitch in too. But it hasn't been an easy journey. But I don't think it's easy for male executives either. I mean, and we've talked about our children a lot, and we've compared notes that we miss this. So it's not just women who give up. When men climb the corporate ladder, there's a price that all our families pay, and you have to balance that. And I will just say, to get personal, when my children got to be teenagers, I actually, in a way, stepped back to have our own business because although I worked as many hours, I was much more flexible than working for a Fortune 500 company. Mm-hmm. I could come and go more. So it's a series of decisions. Mm-hmm. It's not easy. And you always think, ooh. Now, fortunately, I'll just say this. Everybody turned out great. We all get together. We have great grandchildren. But to navigate it, there are moments that you just think, this is a lot.
I can relate.
I must say that, you know, I've met Kate's husband now a couple of times, and I think if every woman had a husband like that,
yeah, <that's right. laughs>
it would be a lot easier, I think, for women to succeed in the profession. He's just amazing. You know, for me, you know, if you look at my personal life, you know, as I have mentioned a number of times, you know, I'm quite open about it. I come from a quite humble family. But I have come from a family where, you know, my father was probably one of the first one in that area where we live. He offered the property equally to two of his daughters, my sisters. And now it's legally required, but that time it was not legally required. Mine was the family. My younger sister, she's the first girl from my village to travel out of the country. You know, my parents allowed that. So I have been very fortunate to live in that family environment. But as I grew up and of course started getting into the professional life, so that's why, because of that family, very fortunate family background I had, you know, of course, when I talk to Kate, of course, I know she's female, but I see her as president. She is the president. And that, in many ways, allows for that relation to be very professional. And I have practiced this all my life. I have had my female bosses. I have many of the colleagues, female colleagues, who have worked with me. And actually, and this is one story I recognized 3-4 years ago when I started as a Secretary General. The COVID-19 came. There was no senior management team in place. I had to do the recruitment and everything. And I was supported by 3 young colleagues, Liana, Cindy, and Elisa. They ran the Secretary General's office for 7 months until we had the senior management in place. Mm-hmm. So I had the trust on these 3 young, highly qualified professionals. And that's the type of confidence I have on the colleagues. Now, of course, when we look collectively, as I mentioned in the first question, we still have some work to do. Mm-hmm. We are not where we should be. But for me personally, this has been, both gender and diversity has been my commitment. And I'm really committed, you know, in the next 4 years working with Kate to make it better when I leave than when I inherited. And that's absolutely commitment. Of course, the ideal would be we achieve. And that's where we achieve the gender balance. Now, but there are also a few dilemmas, Sasha, here in my head. You know, of course, when we talk about the issue of the work-life balance, a lot of times I have struggled that how do we manage that? And actually, when I was in Davos last month, mm-hmm. I engaged in a discussion to challenge other colleagues to say that, help me here. Because when you talk about work-life balance, in many ways, at least in my view, it's put too simplistic. So 9 to 5 is work, and then the rest is life. Mm-hmm. But your head doesn't work like that. You know, you cannot separate in your head that between 9 to 5 you think work, and from 5 you stop thinking work. Or when you come at 9 to office, you don't thinking about your home. If your child is sick or your, you know, mother is not well. So, and this is one of my struggle in the head, that how do we truly bring that work-life balance, not only from the number of hours point of view, but from more holistic point of view. And this is something I'm trying to learn. I'm trying to find solution. And I hope one day I will reach there. But there are also certain other factors, the differentiation, you know, the differentiation of age. You know, when I had engaged in some of the conversation, and I have met a group of colleagues who have a serious issue around the job security, that we don't have enough job security. And I have also met a group of colleagues. What is that? I don't want to hang around here forever. I look for new opportunities. So it's age differentiation, the geographic differentiation. So these are some of the things I'm trying to learn and be better to understand. These differentiating factors, how do we factor in our policies and actions so we have more holistic approach rather than very simplistic approach? So these are the dilemmas. I don't have the answer, but I'm trying to find some.
So I'd just like to react. I mean, I think one of the things the women's movement has done very good, you never would have had that conversation about work-life balance. And I would challenge that applies to males and females. Right. You know, I am seeing in my children that spouses take different times off to stay. Never happened when I was starting. I mean, my youngest is 40. That never happened 40 years. But every one of our three children, each of the spouses, I have two daughters and a son, have taken time off to deal with children issues or elderly parent issues or whatever. And I think a real positive of the Me Too movement and women is we just look at people as people and say, how do we ensure the quality of life for them and their family is appropriate? Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm thrilled to hear Jagan speak about this, but I think it's a broader issue that was forced by the women's movement, quite frankly.
So would you say in conclusion, in closing of this conversation, would you say that we should be open to adjusting our policies to individual circumstances because it is not gender specific, it is just people specific and everyone has different circumstances? I'd like to get both of your thoughts, just to conclude this conversation on a positive note, where you think we can take this conversation about policy around work balance for staff at IFRC.
See, I feel very strongly it is a gender neutral. I had a meeting at some point, and one of a staff member's child had just come out of the hospital that day, and I said to him, why are you here? And I said, you go home, and if you don't go home, I'm not going to talk to you the whole time you're here anyway, so you might as well go home. The point was that I could say he was suffering, his wife was home, baby yes. just came out of the hospital. Yes. And so what I'm hoping, as I said before, what this has done, having women have a more prominent role, is how do we put families and work and individual needs, regardless, mm-hmm. on a even playing field, right. as you talked about right. earlier. And I think, you know, that's, I mean, and clearly as a female leader here and as president, I have a real passion to reach out. I try to stop and talk to young women in the cafeteria, in the lift. If I can help mentor them, I want to do that. I really do. I want to have a forum for presidents of national societies to be seen so they have the opportunities to come to the board, to have roles in the international conference. That's important to me. But equally important is creating a work environment where we get the best from people because they're able to have that right yes. balance, mm-hmm. which I believe in the long run makes you more productive, more innovative, and more collaborative. And we talk so much about working together here, so much. And if we can foster that kind of collaborative mm-hmm. attitude, it's a win-win.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Kate.
No, I think, Sasa, my feeling is that that's the ambition. We are not there yet.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
I think we still have the level of imbalance, which we need to have slightly more assertive action. So I want to reach there, what you described. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, I think we do need to have slightly more assertive actions to create those opportunities, mm-hmm. those level playing field, and also better understanding, you know, what I think Kate rightly said earlier, that, you know, the women tend to look at the job description too literally. Mm-hmm. If the job description says 10 years job experience requirement, and if they have 9 years, 6 months, they will not apply. Mm-hmm. Men will apply even if they are 6 years. I will just add it. So these are the things I think we are mm-hmm. still not there. Same thing during the interviews. You know, the men tend to oversell and the female tend to undersell. So we still have some of those differentiation. We haven't reached there. So mm-hmm. I still believe that we need a positive reinforcement. But I think at some point in few years, we need to reach that. But once we have done that in our workplace, I would really like to feel, whether you are a man or a woman, you feel that you are there because you are qualified.
Yes.
You earned it because you deserve it. You won it fair and square. And have that mindset to be on the table as equal mm-hmm. and not sit in the back chair, but come to the front chair. So I think we do need to do that, do more of that. And at least from my point of view, as I mentioned earlier, when I have my colleagues sitting in front of me, they are professional, well-qualified colleagues. And that's how I want to see them, and that's how I want to treat them.
Thank you, Jagan, and thank you, Kate. It's been a pleasure and an honor to speak to both of you today. And happy International Women's Day.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to People in the Red Vest, a podcast of inspiring stories as told by people from the IFRC. This podcast was produced by Malcolm Lucard and me, Alexandra Sasha Gorishek, with production and engineering support from Damien Naylor. Promotion and marketing by Maxime Bouchard, graphic design by Valentina Shapiro, and web support from Chris Acqua and Patrick Tai. For more inspiring stories, subscribe to wherever you listen to podcasts.